Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. President Trump has already cemented at least one part of his legacy, a transformation of the federal judiciary. That transformation is vividly seen in the nation's Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's America's largest circuit court, covering nine western states that are home to more than 60 million people. One judge recently told the Los Angeles Times that the appointment of 10 judges at once in the Ninth Circuit has, quote, sent a shockwave through the system. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is riding that wave.
But the good news is we've changed the Ninth Circuit in a dramatic way, as you know, and it's no longer, you know, the far-left court that it used to be.
Well, the Ninth Circuit has long been seen as a liberal legal bastion, and as you heard, McConnell's bete noire, though it's been more of a centrist court for the past couple of decades. Still, it's a powerful case study of who will be making critical legal decisions for the next generation, why they're there on the bench, and how that might change laws that we all live under. So this hour on Point, the Ninth Circuit and reshaping the federal judiciary. And we will begin in Washington today with Andrew Craigie. He's Congress and Judicial Nominations Reporter for Law 360, a legal news service that's operated by a subsidiary of LexisNexis. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be with you.
So first of all, tell us about exactly, in your view, how significant is this transformation of the Ninth Circuit? Is it sending a shockwave through the system, as one judge did tell the LA Times?
Courts move slowly in pretty much everything, so it's like a slow shockwave. But when I talk with practitioners and professors and senators, they all agree that the Ninth Circuit is definitely changing. And the reason this one circuit is so important, it doesn't cover all the country, but it covers California plus eight other states, 60 million people. So it's a pretty huge impact. Mm.
So then let's talk a little bit about who these new judges are. How many new judges has the Trump administration put in the Ninth Circuit?
President Trump has seen 10 judges confirmed to the Ninth Circuit, so 10 of his picks out of 29 total seats. And that means that there's a sort of partisan balance of Republican appointees at 13, and then Democratic appointees are still a majority at 16. And everyone thinks it's important to emphasize that most judges are not especially partisan. They're just very smart and care about applying the law. And the vast majority of cases don't divide along political lines. But the really important ones that make the headlines and have a big impact on issues like immigration and abortion, of course, do tend to divide along partisan lines.
Well, we'll get into more about why some folks on, I suppose, one side of that political divide wonder if that presumption about sort of judicial fairness could be applied to these Trump appointees, given the Federalist Society's role in all of this. But first of all, Andrew, if you could, can you just give us a sort of circuit court 101 here? You said 29 judges on the Ninth Circuit. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. So that sounds like a lot. I mean, is that typical for an appellate court?
Most of the circuits are more around the 10 or 15 range. Some of them are quite small, you know, dating back to 100, 200 years ago when they were started in the Northeast and the, you know, Mid-Atlantic were the only states that existed. And so the Ninth Circuit size is part of what makes the Trump appointees' impact so vast.
I see.
Even though they haven't, quote unquote, flipped the circuit from a majority of Democratic appointees to a majority of Republicans. In most circuits, that would determine the ultimate sort of power. But the Ninth Circuit, because it's so big, has so many judges across such a vast area, even Alaska and Hawaii, they don't, when they do sort of appeals, what's called en banc reviews, other circuits do every judge on the circuit. But the Ninth Circuit a few decades ago decided that's just too much to handle. Let's be sensible about this. And they do pretty much a random drawing and just do 11 judges. And so, you know, you can play at flipping coins or rolling dice and figure out the probabilities have vastly increased of getting a majority of Republican appointees on any 11-judge panel that reviews appeals or the original 3-judge panel that decides the appeals on first hearing.
Okay. So then who are some of the judges that that President Trump has appointed to the Ninth Circuit?
Yeah, the most recent ones who, you know, I've covered their confirmation battles and were quite controversial. Judge Lawrence Van Dyke was Solicitor General in Montana and Nevada, and he drew a not qualified rating from the American Bar Association, which they said they talked to 60 lawyers, judges, and other colleagues he's worked with, and they had a really unusually personal, scathing letter alleging that he was arrogant and lazy and questioning whether he'd be fair to LGBT people. And Democrats pointed to some of his writings in law school 15, 20 years ago that, you know, questioned same-sex marriage. And conservatives said, you know, this is a guy who understands a different aspect of the West. He's fought for, you know, he knows the land issues out there that Westerners care about. And then another reason he was controversial is sort of Senate insider baseball, but really matters for determining who gets on courts. Normally, up until 2017, there was something called a blue slip, which gave senators basically a veto for judges who were going to sit in their states. And circuit judges oversee multiple states, but they're sort of assigned to a single state. And in 2017, Republicans decided to drop the blue slip requirement for these appeals courts, these circuit judges. It's still in force for the first level at district courts, but they dropped it for circuit judges, which made a big difference because the White House no longer has to negotiate with Democratic senators to find people that are mutually agreeable. So Nevada now has 2 Democratic senators, both of whom were vehemently opposed to Judge Van Dyke's appointment and argued that they should have a say in who sort of represents Nevada on the bench.
Interesting. So, well, we also will talk about how in 2013, 2014, it was the Democrats and Harry Reid who, you know, undertook the so-called nuclear option regarding not needing a supermajority anymore to get folks onto the bench. So there's sort of bipartisan efforts to make the process easier and quicker here for federal judiciary appointments. It's important to note that, and we'll drill down to that even more. But I want to stay, Andrew, with the current makeup of the Ninth Circuit. So there was that Van Dyke, that one very controversial Trump appointee that you mentioned, but that's one out of 10. Are the other 9 equally controversial or not?
It's a pretty wide mix.
Okay.
So confirmed along with him was Judge Patrick Bumate, who some celebrated as being a rare Filipino-American and openly gay man. And he was actually sitting next to now Judge Van Dyke at their confirmation hearing. And Senator Lindsey Graham turned to Bumate and said, "Well, you're gay. Do you think Van Dyke could judge you fairly?" Which Republicans took as confirmation when Bumate said yes, and Democrats said that's absurd. Bumate is also quite conservative and was opposed by Californians, California senators, but wasn't, you know, drew a qualified or well-qualified rating from the ABA. And then there have been some sort of more middle-of-the-road typical appointees. Oregon senators seem to have had a little more success or a better relationship with the White House counsel's office in negotiating over these nominees, and they got a pretty well-respected state judge, Judge Danielle Hunsaker, who joined the bench.
So then, Andrew, in that case, I mean, there's been a lot of writing. You've been covering this for a while. I mean, can we fairly say that this is a transformation of the Ninth Circuit? Because it seems as if it was considered this legal liberal bastion, as I said before, for several decades. But that hasn't necessarily been the case. So how much of a change are we seeing now?
Yeah, I talked with lawyers who are for the circuit a lot and who have clerked there and sort of know its history. And what I heard is that the liberal reputation dates back to the 70s when President Jimmy Carter, he never got a Supreme Court nomination, but they said this was his consolation prize, that Congress had enacted legislation that added seats. I think it was 10 seats to the Ninth Circuit. And so he got to appoint a whole new slew of judges. And he went with folks who were more diverse, but also some who were definitely more liberal, the sort of liberal lions like Judge Reinhardt that people look to. And one of the judges at a Senate confirmation hearing said, if my conscience conflicts with the law, I'll go with my conscience. And that's a very different mindset than any judge would have today. So that's sort of the origin. And there have been really sweeping Ninth Circuit rulings on the environment, dating back to school desegregation. So they had a major impact. But experts tell me that Clinton and Obama appointees were more middle of the road. The Senate helped to make sure they were centrist. So it's been – the Ninth Circuit's been getting more and more centrist over the decades. And as one lawyer told me, Mitch McConnell said it's not the far-left court it used to be, but used to be is a long time ago.
Now, Andrew, we've got about a minute to go before we have to take a break here. I think one thing that we ought to emphasize is that, sure, the cases that come out of the circuit court sometimes, some a very few number of them end up at the Supreme Court. But the reason why these circuit courts are so important is that the vast majority of the cases that end up there don't go any farther, right? So it's essentially, it is the last stop for a lot of these legal battles that make the decisions out of these circuits, and in this case, particularly the Ninth, final, right? It's like the Supreme Court for districts.
Yeah, for 60 million people, yeah. It's just south of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court gets about 7,000 applications each year to review cases. And a lot of them, you know, have real complicated legal issues that could use resolving. But the Supreme Court takes about 150, about 2%.
About 2%. And so the other 98%, if you're in the Western United States, the last stop is the Ninth Circuit. And we've got a whole bunch of new judges there who will be hearing those cases. So Andrew Craigie, Congress and Judicial Nominations Reporter for Law 360, hang on here for just a second. We're using the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals as a case study to further examine the transformation of the federal judiciary going on under the Trump administration. We've got a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're doing a case study of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Western United States and the 10 relatively new judicial appointments that the Trump administration has made, or President Trump specifically, has made to the Ninth Circuit, and what that tells us about the transformation of the federal judiciary overall. I'm joined today by Andrew Craigie. He's Congress and Judicial Nominations Reporter for the website Law 360. And joining us now from Richmond, Virginia, is Carl Tobias, a law professor at Richmond University who tracks federal judicial appointments. Carl Tobias, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask you, Carl, the same question I started off with Andrew at the beginning of the hour. How significant do you think these 10 new judges are in changing or transforming the Ninth Circuit?
Well, I think Andrew made a number of very good points. 10 out of 29 is an incredible percentage, one-third of the court. Justice Byron White used to say when we added one new justice, it totally discombobulated the Supreme Court. And so you have a very similar dynamic, only many more judges joining a court. And so it will make a difference. The question is what kind of difference it will make. And in some ways, it's too early to tell because so far, most of the judges, seven or eight of them, have not even been on the court for a year, and mm-hmm. some of them haven't even written opinions yet. And so we'll have to see. But over time, it is likely to make a pretty substantial difference.
So why have Republicans, and they've been very clear on this, why have Republican lawmakers been so focused on filling those vacancies, some of which were deliberately held open, I should note, but filling vacancies at the circuit court level?
Well, for the reasons you just discussed with Andrew, because these are the Supreme Courts in the regions where the judges sit. Fewer than 1%, I think, of the cases are taken by the Supreme Court. So it's the Supreme Court for the Ninth Circuit for the states in which these cases are brought. And so it's incredibly important. A district judge can't even bind the same judges, the judges in the same courthouse where the judge rules. But the Ninth Circuit decisions bind all nine states and all the district judges there. And so they're extremely important. And what has happened is we are down to one vacancy out of 179 appeals court judgeships around the country. It hasn't been that few since Ronald Reagan was president in 1984. And so they've focused like a laser on that, to the disadvantage of the district courts, where there have been as many as 150 vacancies, and emergency vacancies. There are still 41 of those around the country.
Interesting. Okay. Now, I'm seeing here that as of 2020, President Trump has appointed one in four of the current judges in circuit courts across the country. Is that right, Carl?
Exactly. 51 mm-hmm. out of 179 around the country. And the Fourth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit is probably the most substantial example, but there have been many other courts, and again, flipping the Second, Third, and 11th circuits from majority Democratic appointed judges to majority Republican appointed judges.
Okay.
And I would just say that,
yeah, go ahead, Andrew.
That Republicans are very enthusiastic about this. Obviously, the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia's vacancy was kept open, and that was part of what motivated some conservatives who are wary about President Trump to vote for him, and he's very well aware of that. He brought together sort of a pep rally in the White House in November to celebrate the fact that they had confirmed a quarter of the federal judiciary, or sorry, a quarter of the circuit judges. They're about to reach a quarter of the federal judiciary pretty soon. And Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, he told me that he expects this legacy will live on for 50 years. Senators are very open that sometimes they'll, you know, suggest a slate of nominees, and the White House will say, who's youngest? There's a lot of interest in aiming not just at sometimes more conservative judges, but also younger ones who could be on the bench for 30, 40, even 50 years.
Well, I'm seeing that at least six of the judges are under the age of 40, Andrew. So they really are young.
Right. I would defer to Professor Tobias as to how unusual that was historically.
Is that unusual, Carl?
Yes. They are incredibly young, less so than you might expect, and less so than would happen in a second administration were the president to be reelected, probably. But in the Ninth Circuit, I think probably the average age of those 10 is somewhere in the 40s and probably mid-40s or so. And so that makes a huge difference. On the other hand, they are replacing – six of them are replacing Republican appointees, and two others are replacing Democratic appointees who were quite moderate. And so the discrepancies might not be so substantial. But remember, they're replacing people who are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and the new judges will serve for 30 or 40 years. And so that could be substantial.
Yeah. So we have to talk about where these recommendations are coming from in terms of who the president wants to put on the bench, because many of them, most of them, all of them, are they coming from the Federalist Society? I mean, the White House has basically tasked the Federalist Society, that the conservative legal group, to come up with, I don't know, a slate of recommendations, Carl. Is that right?
Well, especially at the appellate courts, yeah. That's true, because Leonard Leo, till recently the executive vice president of the Federalist Society, has had substantial responsibility for recommending those nominees. And the president, I think, has pretty much followed all of his recommendations. I think it's true of many of the 10 appointed to the Ninth Circuit are Federalist Society members and have been active.
Well, I'm just looking at a quote here from someone who interviewed you in the Christian Science Monitor late last year. And you said at that time, the people appointed have been young, extremely conservative ideologically, and mostly recommended by Leonard Leo. Have we had a situation like this before, where a president turns to essentially an outside group to provide recommendations for who he should put on the bench?
Well, the argument is that essentially this has been outsourced to the Federalist Society. Don McGahn, the first White House counsel, rejected that and said, look, I'm in charge here, and it was insourced to me. But it is important to remember that Leonard Leo has been central to the nomination and confirmation of the last few Republican Supreme Court justices. And he was relatively active, but not as active in the Bush administration for George W. Bush. And you also need to remember there's a lot of dark money that's moving around to support both the Federalist Society and appointing conservative judges to the federal bench.
Mm. Andrew, what do you think about that?
I think Senate Republicans would say that an outside group that has been involved for, let me do the math, 70 years is the American Bar Association, which some conservatives in the Senate say they point out that this group takes positions on some issues. And the ABA has had this special role of providing these ratings and evaluations after doing dozens and dozens of interviews with lawyers and judges that nominees work with. And this became more of an issue, like many things related to judges, just in the past 20 years, where this was sort of a nonpartisan, behind closed doors, sort of genteel process up until at least into the 80s. And then when George W. Bush became president, he stopped sending his possible nominees to the ABA in advance of nominating them. And then President Obama returned to doing that. And so it sort of reinforced the sense among conservatives that the ABA is more likely to rate GOP nominees as not qualified, when maybe some Obama picks got rated that, but they just dropped them before even announcing it.
Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Just a quick question about even the nature of the conversation is you're looking at the impact on decisions, the outcome determinative nature of the political affiliation of the appointed judges. And I'm wondering if that undermines the ultimate societal faith in the legitimacy of the decisions that they reach.
Mm. Mark, thank you for that question. Carl Tobias, do you have an answer for him?
Well, I think Andrew was pointing out that in the vast majority of cases, the three-judge panels agree, and there's not a dissent. But in the high-profile, culture war, controversial cases, I think you do see some splintering along partisan lines. And so it's hard to dispute the notion that their judiciary does not look relatively political in those kinds of cases, which are a small percentage but an important part of the federal docket.
Well, so I'm going to bring into the conversation another guest to help us think through this. So joining us now is Rory Solberg. She's a political science professor at Oregon State University, researches and writes about judicial nominations, and is joining us from Corvallis, Oregon. Professor Solberg, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So I think one of the – I just want to dig in a little bit more into the role of the Federalist Society here. And Andrew's point about the American Bar Association, point taken, point well taken here. But the Federalist Society today, I mean, do we know Have they clearly articulated the reasoning or the things that their recommended future judges have to do in order to make it to that list that they're putting in front of President Trump?
Not as far as I can tell. Okay. I haven't seen any statement from the Federalist Society about sort of what their criteria are in terms of who they put forward, except that they are members in good standing. But if you look at the Ninth Circuit appointees, again, just since we're talking about the Ninth Circuit, yeah. If you look at their resumes and generally speaking, they are equivalent or if not higher than what we normally expect from a federal judge. I think all 10 of them have clerked for a federal court. Most of them have clerked, all but one, I think, has clerked for circuit courts and or Supreme Courts. They've mostly served in private practice. They have experience as prosecutors. The big piece missing that we have seen in more recent years, and I believe one of my colleagues have already mentioned this, is that they don't have lower court judicial experience.
Mm. Well, so then how is this different, or perhaps is it not at all from what we've seen in the past? Because the concern is, and I guess what I'm asking is this concern a legitimate one, that perhaps these judges are more ideological than we've seen before? Rory, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that Professor Tobias was absolutely correct, that it's a little too early to tell, in the sense that most of Trump's picks for the Ninth mm-hmm. Circuit haven't been on the court that long, haven't been making decisions. So we can't see how they are deciding to really see how their ideology is or is not affecting them. Concerns in terms of the Federalist Society, I think one of the ideas that we could talk about is that when all of your picks are coming from this one particular group that is known for having a particular view of the law, is that you're not getting a lot of diversity in terms of jurisprudential philosophy, even if you also have a similar ideology. Whereas I'm not sure that's necessarily been the case before, and Professor Tobias can correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay, and Carl, I'll turn back to you in a second, but Rory, if I may, for folks who may not fully understand the difference between ideology and philosophy of jurisprudence, right. Is there a difference between the two?
I think there is, because again, you can see this. You can see this on the Supreme Court. You can see this on the circuit courts. You know, when you have a panoply of people who cross the ideological spectrum and also have different views of the law, they still come to unanimous decisions in a great number of cases, right? That means okay. that when the law comes before them, they can agree, regardless of their ideology, that the law is clear. And judges have different perspectives on what is appropriate and how much to allow their ideology to come in, right? I think most of them would say they don't allow it at all. But even from a political science perspective, while we know that ideology, and we mostly have a lot of information on the Supreme Court, but we do have some studies on the circuit courts as well, ideology does affect decisions. It's not the only factor that affects decisions.
I see. But, then again, Carl, I keep coming back to this notion that it's politicians who have been focused like a laser on getting these appointments through. So, I mean, there's a political thrust to this that unfortunately we can't ignore, right?
Well, it's been in the system since the beginning.
Right.
But I think it's really important to differentiate between the appeals court nominees and confirmees and the district court ones. District judges are principally recommended by the home state senators and are appointed for their competence in moving cases as opposed to their ideology. And I think that's been reflected in the people whom the president has appointed. And so you have to differentiate that from the appeals courts.
Well, Andrew Craigie, I know I've got about a minute before I have to let you go here. How many more appointments does the president have in front of him? I mean, how much further across the country, not just in the Ninth Circuit, how much more could this transformation of the federal judiciary, how much more of a transformation could we see?
Right. Mitch McConnell has promised that he'll keep confirming judges all the way through 2020, even including if a Supreme Court vacancy were to arise. He says the situation is different from 2016, and the election year principle doesn't apply when the Senate hold when the same party holds the Senate and the presidency. There are about 70 district court vacancies remaining, and many of them are in California, whose courts are kind of desperate for new judges with crushing caseloads. New Jersey, New York, these are blue states, and negotiations have been tricky between those Democratic senators and the White House. So the rest of the year might look a little different. It's less about ideology, like Professor Tobias said, more about competence. But if President Trump is reelected, we could see a whole bunch of Democratic appointees who might have been holding on, ready to retire.
Well, Andrew Craigie, Congress and Judicial Nominations Reporter for Law 360, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Carl Tobias and Rory Solberg, I'll just ask you to hang on here for a second. We are looking at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals of the United States as a sort of test case, a case study in terms of the transformation of the federal judiciary nationwide. There's a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Western United States and the number of new judges there that have been appointed by the Trump administration, and using that as a case study to look at the transformation of the federal judiciary overall. I'm joined today by Carl Tobias. He's a law professor at Richmond University. Rory Solberg also joins us. She's a political science professor at Oregon State University. And let's go to Tyler, who's calling from Columbus, Ohio. Tyler, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just calling to comment on this new slew of judges possibly being a good thing for the Ninth Circuit, given that the Ninth Circuit is the highest rate of being overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I know it's tempting to think, well, maybe that's because there's a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. But in addition to overall being overturned, when it comes to unanimously being reversed, the Ninth Circuit also takes the top spot. It's more than three times more likely than the least likely circuit to be reversed by a unanimous decision.
Well, so Tyler, then first of all, let me just ask you, when you say it's the highest rate of being overturned, you mean in the number of cases or the percentage of cases coming out of the Ninth that end up in front of the Supreme Court?
The percentage of cases. So obviously they hear far more cases than other circuits, but there's a 2018 testimony from Brian Fitzpatrick. He's a law professor at Vanderbilt who broke it down into number of cases overturned per 1,000 cases heard, in which case the Ninth Circuit takes the top spot overall, and they also take the top spot of being unanimously reversed. They are unanimously reversed about 20% more often than the next highest circuit and about three times more often than the lowest percentage circuit.
Well, Tyler, thank you for that call. Carl Tobias, let me turn back to you here because I'm seeing some conflicting numbers. I mean, the Washington Post has reported that the Ninth Circuit was only the fourth most reversed circuit in the 2017-2018 term, whereas Tyler was saying it was number one. So where's the truth here?
Depends on how far back in time he's going. At one point earlier, it might have been most reversed, but in recent terms, it has not been. In fact, where he is in the Sixth Circuit, that court has been reversed the most. But the numbers are very small, and so it's very hard to draw conclusive determinations. And the Supreme Court grants cert only on cases that are really close and really interesting. And it shouldn't be surprising that California and some of the Western states do take on extremely controversial issues, and we know them. The recent Title X cases, the cases over public lands, the cases involving immigration, racial discrimination, and a host of other very controversial issues. So I don't know that it tells us a whole lot about the court in terms of its decision making and whether it gets decisions right. And of course, the Supreme Court is quite conservative, so you would expect it to overturn a more liberal court on occasion.
Yeah, and again, we're only talking about a tiny fraction of the 7,000 cases a year that the Ninth Circuit hears that ends up in front of the Supreme Court. Rory Solberg, did you have a thought about that?
Well, no, I completely agree. If you look at the most recent statistics from the U.S. courts and the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the Ninth Circuit actually isn't the most overturned currently. It's a common misconception about the Ninth Circuit. And given their much larger caseload, it's actually, they do quite well, I think.
Yeah. You know, I feel like I'm just going to return to what I believe are the fundamental set of questions here, because on the one hand, roughly the system that we have for federal judiciary appointments hasn't changed that much, except for these two key things that Andrew Craigie was talking about earlier. One is when Democrats in 2013, 2014 used the nuclear option regarding filibusters and federal judges. And then second, that the blue slip issue for these appellate court judges. So those are two significant changes here. I just want to remark on that again or underscore that again. But if it didn't, I have to wonder, and I'm sorry if I'm muddling through this, but what I'm trying to get to
is hard stuff.
Yeah, well, something does feel different at this moment in terms of the intensity, the approach, the focus, the kinds of judges, the numbers of judges that one administration, that one president has been able to put on the bench. I mean, is it different, or people, all the many, many dozens of articles we've read and people we've talked to in the past couple of days, are they simply overreacting to what is essentially normative in how we put judges on the bench?
I do think that there is something different, although there is some data that shows that despite the loss of the blue slip and despite the loss of the filibuster, Trump's judges aren't actually getting on the bench quite as quickly as we think. They're still taking quite a bit of time. Although for the Ninth Circuit, when you look at the time between nomination and confirmation, those folks have been pretty rapidly put on the bench. But overall, the average when I looked at it, I was sort of shocked about, it's taken, several hundred days and such. You would think, you get the sense that it's happening just fire. So those things are different. And I do think that there is a sense that something's different because of the about 100 nominations or vacancies that were held over for Trump. So it feels like he gets to have sort of a bigger footprint. And the coordination between the president and the Senate Majority Leader has been, I think, also somewhat unusual in terms of trying to get these judges through. When you see, a panel of five judges and each senator gets 5 minutes to talk to all of them, and that's the confirmation hearing. I think all of these things suggest an expediency that we're not used to when it comes to the federal judiciary.
That's interesting. So can I just ask you a follow-up to that? An expediency for an appointment that is a lifetime appointment.
Yes. Yes. And so that is, I think, somewhat concerning. On the other hand, I don't want to, flash all sorts of alarm bells in the sense that, if we take a look, step back to 2008, when I was looking at the Ninth Circuit, when President Obama came in, you had 15 Democrats to about 12 Republicans appointed on that court. There was one vacancy, and President Obama got to fill one new seat. After President Obama finished, there was 18 Democrat appointments to 10 GOP appointments and one vacancy. So, he was able to remake the circuit. And I think this is sort of a teeter-totter effect that we see presidency after presidency. So there is that kind of question. You know, President Obama put seven people on the circuit, but it wasn't seven people in 1 year. It was seven people over the course of 4 years, right? So a little bit more time to absorb. So when we think about the Ninth Circuit as a case study, I think the concerns are how quickly we filled the 10 vacancies, added to the fact that, again, these folks are coming in without previous judicial experience. So there's that lack of socialization of what it means to be a judge all at one time. And so that, you know, could quite frankly shake up the norms of the court when you have that large of a percentage of the bench that, you know, might come in with a very different idea. They haven't, you know, sort of learned the ropes, so to speak. And that's different.
Mm. Carl Tobias, what do you think?
Well, I just want to point out that the White House and the Senate, as Roy suggests, have worked very closely together. But I also want to say that the Republicans have eviscerated most of the customs that govern a judicial selection, both the nomination process and the confirmation process. The White House has not actively consulted with home state senators, especially on the appellate level. And the abolition of the blue slip for the purposes of home state senators saying who will sit in chambers in their states has really dramatically transformed the process. And expedition is not the most important thing. The most important thing is to fully and rigorously question people who will hold life tenure on the appellate and district courts. And I'm not sure that we're seeing that. And so that's a real issue for both the White House and the Senate. And I hope that those norms will come back into place very soon. But many of them have been eroded, if not eliminated.
I mean, but I would also think that, you know, some of this erosion, it's not all just happening now, right? We saw some of this, you know, slight erosion of the process under George W. Bush. We saw erosions of the process under President Obama with sort of the unprecedented obstruction. And so, you know, these changes have been, I would say, building over time, and we sort of getting a culmination of the effect under President Trump. But it's not good for the federal structure and the confirmation process.
Well, let's go back to our phones. Let's go to Robert, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello. Just quickly, in my view, I'm old enough to remember the victories for civil rights, women's rights, environment that happened in the 60s and 70s. The Federalist Society, I've been following this for a while, they were formed in reaction to that, and they've already gutted voting rights. And I call it the kind of the old South Southernization of the court. And they're putting on people who, to me, some of in their 30s who have no experience practically. And so that's what I'm seeing with this, in a word, the southernization of the court. These people have their minds made up in certain ways, and they're chipping away at rights of people, particularly the rights that happened with Justice Brennan, Thurgood Marshall, and people like that. Okay.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Michael, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. And this may be a little bit too much to get into, but I at least wanted to offer it for the guests to speak about. And first of all, I've been practicing as an administrative law judge for like 25 years. And what I observe is that conservatives are They're gaming the system, if you will, in the way that judges are selected by hiding judicial philosophy behind a certain jurisprudential method of deciding cases. And let me see if I can explain it quickly.
Well, Michael, just hang on. Michael, one second here. I just want to get the clarification. You said you've been an administrative law judge for 25 years. In what court?
So that's a state administrative law judge.
Okay.
So I decide agency cases.
Okay.
So I'm a lot of times interpreting regulations and statutes, but I'm also using court law to do that.
Okay. Okay. I just wanted to get that clarification. Thank you. So go ahead and your explanation as you were going to offer.
So there are five kinds of arguments that are used to interpret law. There's the language of the law. There's legislative history. There's precedent. There's tradition. And there's policy. And Scalia famously said, we should ignore policy. That doesn't tell us anything about law. We should look at the law's language primarily. That tells you what the intent of the legislature was. So he ignores certain kinds of arguments. And, if you're of a certain bent, you would say he ignored it when it was to his advantage. The problem is that you can achieve a certain end when you're weighing each of these kinds of arguments against each other. And so, they're all apples and oranges. And those judges who say we, first of all, should ignore some kinds of arguments, but also say we should weigh certain kinds of arguments more than others, they can achieve a certain conservative view by doing what I think is less than they should in terms of, So we should rate judges more by the philosophy that they're trying to achieve. We should look at how they're, if you will, promoting corporate views as opposed to more progressive views.
That's as one example. And Michael, forgive me for cutting you off there, but I've got to, I'm headed right towards the end of the show here. Thank you so much for your call, Michael. Carl, I mean, first of all, I just want to give you a second if you wanted to respond to what Michael said.
Well, I think those are interesting questions. And unfortunately, the nominees have not been rigorously questioned about those kinds of issues, what their views might actually be. And that's another part of the system that I think has been eroded. So it would be better if we would have more rigorous questioning in the hearings in Judiciary Committee.
Mm. And Rory Solberg, your thoughts?
Well, I think the caller is sort of pointing to this idea that when all the judges are coming from one particular school of thought, right, then we're not getting this diversity of approaches to the law. And that's sort of what we're getting here when we get, the lists coming specifically right from the Federalist Society.
Mm. Well, we've got about a minute left here. And Carl, if I could just throw one last question to you here, because given that we're in 2020 and eventually everything comes back around to the election, do you think the question of these appointments to the federal judiciary could become a focus or a sharper focus in this election year?
Well, certainly the Republicans plan to campaign on it. They've been using the White House to advance their views. And I think absolutely the president will crow about it, especially in areas like reproductive justice, immigration. He's done it consistently, tweets about it all the time, and his rallies are full of that. And that politicizes the judiciary in a way that I think is unfortunate.
Well, Carl Tobias is a law professor at Richmond University. He tracks federal judicial appointments, speaking to us today from Richmond. Carl Tobias, thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Rory Solberg, political science professor at Oregon State University, my alma mater, by the way, Rory. She researches and writes about judicial nominations. I happen to have grown up in Corvallis, Oregon. So thank you so much for joining us from my hometown today.
Thank you so much for having me.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim, with help from Caroline Love, Liam Knox, and Bradley Noble. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated. and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.